This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
This is, of course, World Wide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show, taking you around the globe, one country at a time. And tonight you have Lana, Barbara, Damien, and myself, Dean.
One of the largest queer film festivals, the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, is in town. Not only do we get to see films about life as a queer person, but we get to see films about being queer from all over the world. Tonight we're off to Iran and we're going to ask the questions, what does it mean to be an LGBTIQ person in Iran? What is the political and social context to being queer in Iran? And why are there more trans acceptance than gay, lesbian and bisexual acceptance in Iran? To understand life in Iran, tonight we're speaking with Malachi Leopold, the director of Alex and Ali, a feature documentary telling the epic love story of an American and an Iranian gay couple reunited after 35 years. Here's a taste of what we have coming up tonight.
I think that in that kind of environment, it would have been much more commonplace to see two men, especially like two young men, you know, hugging or cuddling, I mean, even in public, you know, holding hands. And I mean, that's still common, you know, today in terms of, I mean, there's plenty of places around the world where it's perfect, you know, completely normal to see two men walking down the street and holding hands.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
Well, we're starting off in Russia. Back to Russia. So authorities are trying to shut down the only support group or online support group for LGBTI youths because of their gay propaganda law. So a quite well-known LGBTI youth support group called Children 404 is facing the danger of being shut down because of the country's anti-gay propaganda laws, which were enacted a couple of years ago. So the country's media authority, Roskomnadzor, and the Kremlin-loyal youth organization Young Guard forced the General Prosecutor's Office into action because of a number of complaints, about 150 from citizens. The idea is that a potential breach of the law has happened because they've advertised non-traditional sexual relationships among minors. So as you can imagine, the website is there to support LGBTI youth. So because they're under 18 and it's talking about non-heterosexual relationships, they're inadvertently actually breaching the gay propaganda law. So a court will have to decide whether the group's online presence is violating the law. And the Lena Klimova, this is not the first time that she's been oppressed by the authorities. The founder of Children 404 said she feared that the shutdown was only a matter of time, but she would not give up. Even the powerful media authority will not destroy this Facebook group that easily. And it is just basically a Facebook group.
It's just appalling. It's a travesty what Russia's getting away with.
You would think they'd have better things to do.
You would think so.
But there were 150 complaints.
I know.
Just think of how many people live in Russia. So that must be a really serious problem.
Won't somebody think of the children?
Over to Ireland, where, yes, everybody's excited. We're heading towards the referendum on the 22nd of May. And now, interestingly enough, David Quinn of the Catholic Iona Institute, which actually strongly opposes gay rights in the state, has come out and said that, yeah, the campaign against equality is actually behind. So he sort of says, yeah, the yes side has a big lead and a very substantial lead. And of course, he doesn't know how solid the lead is, but they have the political parties on their side. That's interesting, isn't it? And also he says every second celebrity seems to be on their side. They will spend a lot of money and most of the academia is on their side. It's funny that he quotes so many people being on their side, and it's not unreasonable people in my opinion. So it's quite interesting. Yeah, so let's see what happens there. If even the no people think that the yes people will win, so I think we're in a good position there.
It's in the bag.
It is. It's a big development in Ireland when you think that it's not that many years ago that Ireland was, you know, like, let's face it. I mean, some of us, like me, are old enough to remember the scandal years ago where a woman who'd been sexually molested by a male when she was only 14 was refused permission to leave the country to have an abortion. Yeah. And there were many people who said, well, too bad, so sad. You're just going to have that baby and keep Jesus happy.
Reinforcing those traditional ideas of family and motherhood and parenthood. And
women being carrier cases who don't have any rights of their own.
No. And, you know, it still happens. But over to Japan, where lawmakers have formed a group to end anti-gay discrimination by 2020 for the Tokyo Olympics. Hiroshi Hase, the Liberal Democratic Party member and leader of the committee, said they wanted to avoid a repeat of the Sochi boycotts over Russia's anti-gay law. As it hosts the Olympic Games, there is no doubt that Japanese society will be questioned on how it treats its sexual minorities, and we must substantiate the principles described in the basic plans of the Games, he said. After the outcry and world leaders boycotted the Sochi opening ceremony, the International Olympic Committee in December did add sexual orientation to its anti-discrimination policy, and the Japanese group does plan to draft any bills that will start by meeting with its members of the LGBTI community and studying laws on sexuality orientation in other countries. 38 lawmakers have joined the committee so far, including 13 from the ruling LDP party and 12 from the opposition. So that's really good. I actually boycotted the games and didn't watch them, even though I love the Olympics, because I just refuse to, allow the media and the world to think that it's okay for that kind of discrimination to happen. So,
yeah, I think it's a really good call, because I don't think that Russia would have ever got these games if they had those laws in place when the decision was made. So to come out with that, like, pretty much 5 minutes before the game and say, like, oh, actually, by the way, we're changing our law and it's not cool anymore to be gay. And so I think that didn't really work out for Putin, and he was probably very pissed off, and I think other countries are really trying to avoid that. And it was really good that the Olympic Committee finally added that to their rules.
It's the end of an era, because Qatar got the World Cup, and as we know, again, Middle East, that's where we're going tonight, and it's not exactly favourable for any LGBTI people in Qatar. In fact, any women.
I think that's
sure.
Bit of an understatement there.
True, but I'm not even sure how women are going to be allowed to go and watch the World Cup.
That's been one of the issues.
In fact, one of the issues is, can they even serve alcohol there?
Yeah.
So, you know, look.
What's the whole point of this tournament?
A lot of people were scratching their heads over that one. Also the fact that it's hotter than the sun, so that's not going to be, that's a bit of a challenge for perhaps maybe the South Americans will probably be better than the Germans this time around, because they'll be used to the heat. So yeah, it's the end of an era. In the future, I think they're going to be looking at this quite closely, and these countries are either going to have to put some adjustments in, if only for the games or the World Cup or whatever event it is, or they're going to have to, you know, just basically say maybe we shouldn't be applying in the first place.
Talking about hotter than the sun, where are we to next?
We're in Egypt. Yeah, something very interesting has happened. It's not really an LGBTIQ topic, but a woman has lived as a man for 40 years and was then voted the best mum. So how did that happen? Quite interestingly, this woman, her name is Siza Abu Dawu, so she has been named by officials in her hometown of Luxor as the city's most supportive mother, so she got she will get the award by the president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and she said she's not going to stop living as a man. And how that all came was when her husband died in the 1970s, it was pretty much impossible for her to go to work, and her family wanted to marry her off to another man straight away, but she didn't like any of the fellas that they presented her. And so, and as I said, like, the work was not an option for a woman in those days. So she just decided one day to shave her head, put on men's clothes and start working, making bricks and working in the fields, and later polishing shoes when her body wasn't that fit anymore. And interestingly enough, pretty much everybody knew that she was a woman, but nobody really cared. But at the same time, appearing as a man gave her the opportunity to do what men do, which is a normal thing like sitting in a cafe and like just living a normal life and not being constantly harassed or told or that you can't do certain things. So,
and everyone was too polite and self-effacing to say anything.
So she did that for 40 years and she keeps doing that.
There you go. Oh, good on her.
Just quickly, landmark case challenges anti-gay laws in two countries. Last week, the prominent gay activist Morris Tomlinson, one of the most well-known gay rights activists in the world, who is an attorney in law lecturer, journalist, HIV/AIDS and the LGBTI activist in Jamaica and the Caribbean, challenged laws barring LGBTI people from entering Belize and Trinidad and Tobago at the world's top court. He argued that obscure immigration rules barring entry to LGBTI people violated his freedom of movement rights enshrined in the key Caribbean community treatment. He was unable to visit his 12-year-old son from a previous marriage to a woman. And he says, I don't travel to a country that has a ban on homosexuality entry. So it's really good that he's been able to go and do that. Elton John did obtain a waiver to perform there amid opposition from religious groups because gay sex is illegal in both countries.
This is a big story. So, the Caribbean is not exactly LGBTI friendly for the most part.
No, so, particularly Jamaica has huge social issues.
We've talked about Jamaica a few times. If you want to rifle through our podcasts, you'll find a bit about Jamaica. But yeah, having Trinidad and Tobago and Belize saying that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be maybe asking people if they're gay when they come into the country.
Yeah.
Big step.
And in brief news, in Indonesia, a top Muslim clerical group has called for the death penalty to be imposed on people who have gay sex.
Puerto Rico, the US territory, will no longer defend its gay marriage ban in court.
Costa Rica, same-sex civil unions to be legalised.
Yoo-hoo! And in Scotland, the Pope accepts the resignation of a disgraced anti-gay cardinal.
In the Vatican, the Pope has lunch with 90 prisoners, including a group of 10 gay and transgender prisoners.
In Uganda, country has spent 600 million shillings, which is not as bad as you think. It's 270,000 Australian, on PR to deal with their anti-gay law backlash outside of Uganda.
Philippines. A church backs anti-gay discrimination bill as long as it does not infringe on the exclusive right to choose priests, even on the basis of sexual orientation.
And in Benin, the Lebanese LGBTIs and refugees from Syria, Iraq and Jordan are planning like a pride march on Idaho Day.
And in India, wrapping up worldwide wrap, West Bengal State forms India's first trans development board, and the 12-member board will issue ID cards to transgender citizens and provide employment and educational opportunities and healthcare.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, World Wide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, I am Tim.
And I'm Ben.
From Hallam, Melbourne.
And you are listening to the World Wide Wave
on Joy 94.9.
Taking you around the globe, one country at a time. This is your Fun Fast Facts.
We're off to Iran, or officially the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the capital is Tehran and is also the largest city, serving as the cultural, commercial and industrial centre of the nation. It is a major regional and middle power exerting considerable influence in international energy security and the world economy through its large reserves of fossil fuels, which includes the largest natural gas supply in the world and the fourth largest proven oil reserves. It hosts Asia's fourth largest number of UNESCO World Heritage sites.
It's a diverse country consisting of many different religious and ethnic groups that are unified through a shared Persian language and culture. The population actually grew rapidly during the latter half of the 20th century, increasing from about 19 million in 1956 to around 75 million by 2009.
And that's all because of the Islamic Revolution, which happened in the 1970s. So Iran hosts one of the largest refugee populations in the world, with more than 1 million refugees, mostly from Afghanistan and Iraq, which is surprising given that Iran themselves would have a lot of refugees leaving the country.
Yes.
So since 2006, Iranian officials have been working with the UNHCR and Afghan officials for their repatriation. So they're trying to send them back. According to estimates, about 5 million Iranian citizens have emigrated to other countries, again, mostly since that pesky Iranian revolution in 1979. And if you're wondering why, under the Penal Code of the Islamic Republic of Iran, adopted after that 1979 revolution, homosexuality is a crime punishable by imprisonment, corporal punishment, or in some cases of sodomy, even execution, and any type of sexual activity outside a heterosexual marriage is strictly forbidden.
Yes, any type of sexual relationship, whether it's a heterosexual couple that aren't married, they could be young and in love, whatever, it's just not okay. The new religious government that came to be established after the 1979 resolution classed transsexuals and transvestites, which is the word they used, with gays and lesbians who were condemned by Islam and face a punishment and imprison under the penal code. However, in 1986, transsexuals, as they're called in Iran, were reclassed as being heterosexual. So there's a really interesting thing happening where transsexuality in Iran is legal if accompanied by a sex change operation, which is not only funded by the state but very much actively encouraged. And they carry out more sex change operations than any other country in the world, bar Thailand. So the surgeries are typically funded by the state, at least partially, with homosexual men being really pressured to undergo them, both by government and society, even though there is still an intolerance to transgender people and transsexual people in other societies around the world. And I do suspect this is because it's about reinforcing that heteronormative male-female conduct.
Yeah, and so they obviously have their Sharia law in place. So any homosexual relations that occur between consenting adults in a private area are a crime and carry a maximum punishment of death. Forced homosexual relations, so rape, often results in execution, and the death penalty is legal for those above 18, and if a murder was committed, legal at the age of 15.
However, there has been cases documented where courts have said that minors are actually older than what they are when they've been involved in consensual same-sex activity so that they can enforce the death penalty.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it's pretty full on. So they target both male homosexuality and female sexuality in Iran. It's pretty horrid.
A little less straight than other radio stations. Joy 94.9.
Tonight we are talking to Malachi Leopold, who is the director of the feature documentary screened at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. The feature documentary of Alex and Ali is a telling epic love story of an American and an Iranian gay couple reunited after 35 years separation. Worldwide Waves' Mac McDonald asked Malachi how he came to know about this love story.
So Alex is my uncle. The brief history of our relationship is that I grew up in an evangelical household, and with my uncle being gay, he was an outcast in the family, and so I really didn't have a chance to get to know him. Once I left the house and left the religious environment altogether, I had more opportunities to get to know him. And so it was in 2009, my uncle attended kind of my first big premiere. And it was at that premiere that I asked him about, you know, sending him a few questions to learn more about his time there. And I was interested in, you know, potentially doing a story at the time focused on like a unique perspective into different stories where the characters would be, you know, Muslim, but it would be a different perspective than, you know, from what was being portrayed in the media at the time. This was, kind of post 9/11 era. And when I learned more about his experience, I became interested in documenting.
When you did first say to him, hey, let's make a documentary about this, how did he react?
Well, at first we weren't going to make a documentary. My original plan was I was going to kind of like gather his story in written format, just like we spent about 2 years just emailing back and forth, and I would send him a list of questions and he would reply back with just pages and pages of stories and anecdotes and, you know, his own insights and experiences. And I was planning on using all that I was gathering to write a screenplay and adapt their story, you know, into a fictional film. And it was during the process of, you know, doing the documenting and the emailing that the idea for them, you know, reuniting again came up. And it was at that point that, you know, things shifted to, you know, we would film their reunion. And it really was, even up to the moment that we were actually in Istanbul for the reunion, it was still like we were really like there to film the reunion and their time and to utilize that as part of the, you know, film that we would, you know, adapt. But, you know, we weren't planning on doing a feature-length documentary. And what happened was, while we were there with the events that unfolded, it just became obvious that, like, this really was the story to tell.
Joy 94.9.
It's Romana Schlesinger from the Rainbow Pride Bratislava in Slovakia for Worldwide Wave.
Tonight we've been talking about Iran and talking about a movie that is being screened at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, Alex and Ali, which is all about a love that stood the test of time.
And lots of barriers and continents and all sorts of things.
Or did it stand the test of time? Having seen the movie, I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, it's quite a challenging sort of situation, given that for most of the 35 years they are separated. One of them stuck in Iran and another one in North Carolina. So it's quite a fascinating movie. Our team member, Matt McDonald, spoke to Malachi Leopold, who's the director of the film and the nephew of Alex in the film, and spoke to him about the not only the personal nature of the film and the social and political context of the subjects, but the act of homosexuality is not only illegal in Iran, so is the identity. So Matt asked Malachi, was Ali fearful of being put on film?
He was mixed about it. I mean, he was fearful of potential, like, misrepresentation. Like, the admonition that he gave me when he left was that he wanted to be depicted truthfully and tastefully. I think his biggest concern was frankly us, you know, sort of twisting their story and making it into more of like a, I don't know, like a highly sexualized kind of story, which wasn't our interest or our intent at all.
Alex and Ali met in the late 60s and early 70s. How did they keep their love hidden in those early years?
Well, I think that in that kind of environment, it would have been much more commonplace to see two men, especially like two young men, you know, hugging or cuddling. I mean, even in public, you know, holding hands. And I mean, that's still common, you know, today in terms of, I mean, there's plenty of places around the world where it's perfect, you know, completely normal to see two men walking down the street and holding hands. You know, my uncle had his own place, so, you know, Ali could visit him and, you know, nobody would think, you know, anything was weird about that or, you know, or unexpected about that.
And then Alex left to return to America just around the time of the revolution there in Iran. But the two men managed to keep in contact. Again, how did they maintain that secrecy over 35 years?
Well, the nature of their correspondence was never political, and it was never sexual or you know, gay in nature. They were very careful about, you know, what they talked about, and it was really more about, you know, I love you, I miss you, you know, this is what's happening in my life right now, you know, I hope to hear from you soon, you know, kind of things, as opposed to anything, you know, potentially dangerous. There were many times where they suspected that their mail was either being read or, you know, or confiscated altogether. But, I mean, you know, there was the revolution that carried on for a number of years, and then there was the Iran-Iraq War. So, you know, I mean, the state of affairs just made some things more difficult.
Now, in May 2012, you went with Alex to Istanbul, where Alex and Ali were reunited for the first time in 35 years. Tell us about that moment.
That was probably one of the most joyous and incredible kind of, it was, I don't know, I mean, it was kind of a pivotal moment. I felt very proud of that moment because of just the effort into, you know, into being able to kind of help make that happen. So it was extremely exciting to see, and it was also just, I mean, for me, you know, personally, it was just exciting to see the actual, you know, person behind all of the stories that my uncle would tell. Like, I felt like I knew him, you know, having spent so much time, you know, with my uncle and with the stories, you know, leading up to that moment, but to actually finally, you know, both see them reunite and then, you know, the chance to meet him and talk to him, you know, face to face was absolutely incredible.
As a filmmaker, what challenges did you face in the filming of this documentary?
The biggest challenge was actually like just something we could never have expected. So our like assistant, like our local assistant that we hired, wound up, I think, I mean, I'm still completely unclear to this day, like exactly what happened for him. But our assistant, I believe, he's given us a lot of like signs that he's gay, but he's clearly like sort of closeted, you know, Middle Eastern. I think that at some point during the filming, he developed feelings for Ali and tried to get Ali to leave with him. It was a crazy 24 hours where, you know, we fired him, but then he showed up and brought police and like tried to literally like get us shut down, tried to have me arrested, and tried to convince Ali, you know, that we were all, you know, like, you know, we shouldn't be trusted and that Ali should go and stay with him.
Wow.
So, you know, to have like your handler, you know, at first it just seemed like, you know, we couldn't have gotten luckier. And I mean, his credentials in terms of projects that he'd worked on and so forth, there was never any doubt that he was like an amazing, you know, sort of person for us to work with. But to have that happen was just like, it was shocking, you know, and scary. And like, other than that, the filming itself was fine. I mean, we were very low profile, so we got to film in a lot of places where if we had been a bigger setup, you know, we wouldn't have been able to kind of capture, you know, some of their more just like personal interactions. I mean, frankly, we looked like American tourists who have like, you know, really nice cameras.
That was Malachi Leopold, who's the director of Alex and Ali. I don't know, having watched the movie, I'm not 100% sure that Ali is thrilled at being filmed during the documentary. He's got a bit of a Sideshow Bob in The Simpsons in the episode where he marries Selma or Patty, one of the sisters, you know, oh, you and your little video camera. There's an element of, you know, he sort of looks at the camera a few times and he's sort of like, oh, you again.
Great. Yeah. Yep. But then again, the political content and context of what it means to be gay in Iran and to have that story, like in the interview when they're talking about that 35 years of sending letters and things, but having to be really careful about, you know, those letters not betraying them as being gay or love letters or things, like how strict that must be to really censor yourself so much that you can't even in a letter say, you know, I love you and miss you lots.
I can't help but feel that the population of Iran had to shoot up from 19 million in 56 to 75 million in 2009 just because they need enormous numbers of people to check everyone's mail and be interfering busybodies and go through people's, you know, online postings and things like that. The apparatus must be huge. There must be so many people who work for the state over there.
Yeah. It's interesting. I haven't quite figured out how it works because the revolution in itself is incredibly interesting in that it wasn't like how many revolutions start. There wasn't some upheaval from the people on the ground. It kind of just almost magically happened where there was this revolution that really was about implementing Sharia law that was much more traditional, and it just happened, and I'm still not quite sure where it came from.
Well, that is an interesting part of Iran's past, because previously, just for some context, before 1979 when the Ayatollah took over, it was a populist uprising.
Yes.
It wasn't like a coup, for example, in, say, Argentina in the 1970s where a lot of people really didn't want it. It actually was a populist uprising because the Shah of Iran, who was in power before, was modernizing the country. The country was very Western.
Yeah.
Women could work. They could have jobs outside of the home.
It was
Western culture. That's what was being brought in.
People were, living quite well. They had enough money. They had enough food. They had shelter. It wasn't a really distressed country.
That's true. The issue, though, is in Iran, as is the case now, we're talking secret police, people disappearing, torture, murder of dissidents. Really, things haven't changed that much. It's just a different brand on the, like a different label on the box. So, because that's what happens in Iran now after the Iranian Revolution.
Yes.
So that's the context there. And that's what they do talk about in the movie. The reason that these two were able to meet was because Alex was part of the Peace Corps and their job was to, go to other countries and sort of, build up connections between disparate cultures. And, of course, they did that very well. So, and that's how they got together, and that's ultimately what sort of separated them as well.
The political kind of content and context again, which I always come to because it's so interesting to me about what their lives were like and even the kind of political context after that. They have the Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees, which is an international organisation for refugees, and it's quite interesting. It's just so contradictory where Iran has such a high level of refugees because, of course, after the revolution, they then had war with Iraq, which is now called the First Persian Gulf War, and then the second one, which is what we think of as the Gulf War. So there's refugees happening everywhere. There's groups of people, they're different ethnicities, different religions, and yet they're all kind of centred in a really unique space in which has some of the strictest anti-homosexuality laws in the world, not just looking at death penalty for men, but very specifically to lesbians, which happens more than you think. We have more laws against same-sex sexual activities for women than we sometimes think, looking around the world. But in Iran specifically, it's incredibly bad.
And it's important to remember that Iran is not – the Iranians are not Arabs. So they're Persian. They speak Farsi. They don't speak Arabic.
Yes.
It's a very different culture, and they don't see themselves in that way. So the actual – one of the most interesting parts of the movie is the Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees, which is fascinating. And they talk a lot about how the idea is one of the few countries where you can leave Iran and go to another country without a visa is Turkey, which borders Iran. And it's where people tend to go. And from there, they make their way into other countries.
Yeah.
And that's sort of most of the film, the second half of the film in particular, is actually filmed in Turkey.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely fascinating.
You're listening to World Wide Wave.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, this is Tara from the Fiji Women's Rights Movement on the World Wide Wave.
We spoke to Malachi Leopold, the director of the film Alex and Ali, which is currently screening at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. And there are lots of potential risks that Ali faced going back to Iran, where convictions related to homosexuality face a maximum punishment of death. So Matt asked Malachi if there was any impact on Ali or his relatives from the making of this documentary.
There has been no impact to him on any screen from screens of the film to date, and the film has been out for about a year, primarily in festivals right now. The wider release of the film is anticipated for later this year, and we went through a very rigorous process of analyzing, potential risks to him in terms of telling the story. The choice that we decided on was that the release of the film was actually the one sort of measure of protection that we could provide him, given the persecution that he faced when he returned. To our knowledge, there's no, and just from interactions we had with him and with others, there's no danger to his family. He doesn't have a family other than relatives, but no, he didn't marry, he never had children. So there's no, there's no like danger in terms of his family there. But even to himself personally, the danger that he really faced was the fact that he was completely, invisible, if you will, or anonymous. So the release of this film just according to the experts that we consulted with, from human rights activists to gay refugees from Iran who are now activists, you know, the consensus was that the release of the film, if anything, was the one way that we could provide some kind of protection to him from further persecution. You know, as much as I think people would expect it, would initially think that, oh, it must be dangerous to release the film, we believe that it is safer for him to have the film released than to not be released. If it's not released, his voice is completely silenced, and the risk to him is he could be picked up and persecuted at any time for any reason. And in addition to that, there are all the other things that are happening right now as it relates to Iran, from ISIS to, you know, their nuclear program, where, you know, they're trying to navigate some very difficult territory for themselves, and, you know, and feeling the increasing pressure that has been coming from the results of the sanctions over the years. So there's also, you know, a strong component of bigger fish to fry than, you know, an individual who is no threat to the government and, you know, publicly denies being gay.
Malachi, what do you hope Australian viewers take away from seeing your documentary?
I think that the two things that I hope that people take away are, like, the need right now to really support grassroots equality activists around the world, because the adversity that they are facing, the persecution that they are facing to advance equality in parts of the world where it is just, it's dangerous to be sort of like at the forefront of building, you know, a movement. It's a very different kind of story than, like, here in the United States or even in Australia, where there's been significant progress that's been made around marriage equality, for example. But in many other parts of the world, there's threat of imprisonment or torture, and some countries execution. So I hope that they take away that there's a huge need to support those who are, you know, fighting for equality globally. But then I think on just sort of like a philosophical, emotional, sort of fundamental level, I really hope that people, you know, when they see this story, as devastating as the outcome is, that they walk away with the belief that love has no borders, and that the message is really that love is worth the fight, you know, in spite of the challenges that are being faced right now, that love is worth the fight.
Malachi Leopold, the director of the film Alex and Ali, which is at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival.
I have a few issues about what was just said. What about you, Dean?
Well, having seen the documentary, I think there's some, how can I put it? I think he's being very careful about what he's saying when they talk about the danger that Ali is in from doing the documentary.
Yeah.
And when he talks about how they investigated and they felt that he would be quite safe in doing the documentary, that in and of itself might be true, but not wanting to give away the movie and what actually happens at the end of the documentary.
Yeah.
You know, there are definitely some risks involved from Ali even going to Turkey.
There's specifically, there's a difference between the impact of doing the film, or the impact of being in the film, and the impact of making the film.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think that he really kind of brushed it under the carpet, really talking about the way in which Ali is and has to live in Iranian society. It's so dangerous. You know, he will face the death penalty if he's ever convicted of being a homosexual. And not only being a homosexual, not only being convicted of participating in same-sex sexual activity, but just being convicted of having that identity as a homosexual without being convicted of participating in same-sex sexual activity is incredibly dangerous. And so when he talks about Ali, you know, just having to be careful about it, I think that it really kind of underrepresents the extreme stress that one would have to go through. I think it's hard enough, for example, in a Western country, when you're walking down the street with your partner and say it's nighttime and you're going into a pub or something and you have to think, is this a safe place or not? And, you know, probably nothing bad's going to happen, but you think it. And so imagine being in a place where, you know, people get hung quite often for this.
Hanged. When it's the death penalty, it's actually hanged.
Oh, but, well, there you go.
There you go. Fortunately, we don't know that really in Australia because we don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Look, there's a flaw built into the material in the film, and that is that it's from the perspective of people from North America who try as they might and despite all their best intentions have trouble understanding the realities of life in Iran.
Yeah.
And although they're aware of the realities, it the film is very much from the perspective of North Americans, so it does focus on them a lot more than what we'd probably like to see, which is poor Ali and his plight.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
Hi, my name is Robbie Watt. I'm from Kootjuk, Northern Quebec in Canada, and you're listening to the World Wide Wave.
Well, what an exciting show it's been. A big, big thank you to Malachi Leopold, the director of Alex and Ali, for appearing on the show tonight.
We also want to thank all the people who have joined or interacted with us on Facebook this past week. So if you want to do the same and look at our Facebook page, it's World Wide Wave or W3Joy on Facebook.
And if you're interested in what we look like, we have posted some photos in tonight's show. Big thank you to the lovely Gordon at the front desk, as always. Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
Community radio is all about breaking down stereotypes. Joy 94.9 would love to hear from women who can confidently work with all things engineering and IT. For more info, visit joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.